Welcome to the Media Madness Podcast, where we stop the madness every week by analyzing the news and critiquing the media. I'm Alex Nitzberg, and today we're going to discuss, actually not media bias, but academic bias. So I'm happy to announce that my guest today is Malcolm A. Klein. Mal is the Executive Director of Accuracy in Academia, a sister organization to Accuracy in Media, and AIA is a nonprofit research group reporting on bias in education. Mal edits AIA's monthly newsletter, Campus Report, and he also serves as editor-in-chief of AIA's website, academia.org. So thank you for joining me today, Mal.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Well, it's great to have you, because what we're going to talk about today is the problem that America has with rampant liberal bias in academia. And we talk a lot about media here, but there's a lot of problems in academia. The American school system, whether at the college level or even lower than that, it evidences a lopsided worldview from the teachers, who are typically more of a liberal political and cultural persuasion. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, actually, I think there are so few conservatives in academia that I believe I know them all. In fact, let me just make a point here. That is that up until recently, the military was about as lopsided conservative as academia is liberal, i.e., it was about 80-20 conservative to liberal, Republican to Democrat in the military. But the thing is, it doesn't matter in the military. It does not affect the training course at Paris Island, for example. You know, you're either going to land the plane or not, left or right or center. But in academia, it does. In fact, to give you an idea, there is a book out now. I just reviewed it. And one of the problems with talking to journalists, as you know, is that what is on their mind is usually the last story they wrote. Well, the last one I wrote was a review of this book. It's called Passing on the Right: Conservative Professors in the Progressive University by John Shields and Joshua Dunn. They actually are conservative professors in the Progressive University, one at Claremont McKenna, one in Colorado. But they actually managed to find about 150 conservative professors. And yeah, I would bet that I know them all, particularly since they managed to find conservative sociologists. I think I know all of them, and I can count them on one hand with enough fingers left over to bowl. But to give you an idea, all of the people they interviewed remained anonymous, and about a third of them that they interviewed concealed their politics prior to tenure by passing as liberals. No kidding. But to give you an idea of just how pervasive this is and just how tolerant academia is of dissenting views, I give you this extensive quote. Bear with me, please. We met our first closeted professor in a leafy park about 1 mile from his prestigious Research One University. Though we found a secluded spot, our subject was edgy and spoke softly. When the sound of footsteps intruded on our sanctuary, he stopped talking altogether, his eyes darting about. As the sound of footsteps receded into the distance, the promise of anonymity returned and our interview resumed. Given the drama of this encounter, one might think that he is concealing something scandalous. In truth, this professor is hiding the fact that he is a Republican. It is a secret he guards with great care. This professor of sociology has been in the closet for the better part of a decade, ever since a successful interview for his first tenure-track job. I have found that a few years back, what they would do is at least try to conceal it a little when hiring. They would say, there's a problem with your congeniality. That was the buzzword they were using, congeniality. I have heard this from more than one conservative professor in more than one part of the country. it sounds like they were about to say conservative and had to scramble for another word that began with a hard C sound.
Yeah, it does.
You know, but at any rate, the further problem is that it really wouldn't matter if they were all liberals if what they were teaching were factually accurate. But there is a huge problem in that academics, of all people, do not, when they're doing their books, go to primary sources. And I've read more of this than I ever had cared to, and will read more. It's my job, at any rate. And that's about the one reason you would read what they write, because it is your job to. Students don't have that choice, however. We'll get to that in a second. But they don't go to the Library of Congress. They don't go to the papers, even in presidential libraries, even when those same libraries and those same primary sources are housed in the very universities that they teach in.
So what are they? Are they just presenting their own opinions and presenting those, passing them off as facts? Is that what they're doing?
Sometimes, but more often, they're finding the opinions they like. I can tell you, from having gone to more academic conferences than I'd care to remember, Foucault, Adorno, and just about every left-wing socialist or communist theorist you can imagine gets quoted a lot.
And this isn't something new, is it? I mean, this I know the Frankfurt School, that was a big problem. That started like early in the 1900s. I mean, how long do you think that this has been happening?
We're trying to nail this down. I can tell you one thing. According to the most recent information we had, the actual political breakdown in academia in the 1920s was 1-to-1, Republican to Democrat, or Democrat to Republican. Democrat to Republican, because by the 1950s, it was 3-to-1.
And so what shift took place that allowed that to happen?
We're still trying to nail that down, but there was the New Deal.
Oh.
There was that, yes. But to just move a little bit along, I want to point out an interesting piece of information is that usually gets glossed over is that there are actually parts of academia that are working. They are generally the most free market parts of academia. People get a little confused on this. A free market does not necessarily involve paying for something with money. It involves a trade, more or less. But at any rate, even so, if you look in academia, for one thing, interestingly enough, not that far from the general population, political science departments, surprisingly, are more balanced than English departments. And it's because these are, to one degree or another, disciplines where people are actually, there is actually a demand and a supply, and the supply has to meet the expectations of the demand, i.e., deliver on the study of economics, you know. And by the way, an interesting point about political science. Michael Munger, who's a pretty libertarian political scientist at Duke, was revealing, this is like 10 years ago, but it hasn't changed much since. He was revealing that he had more students applying for his class in political science than in every course offered in the English department. Every elective course offered in the English department. These things could not survive without a government subsidy or mandate. And lest you think that this is biasing, would be biasing academia towards the utilitarian rather than the, shall we say, humanitarian, the humanities. Let's point out, there's only about a half a dozen great books programs in the country, and they all have waiting lists. But again, this is the market at work. People are seeking a supply of something and finding it, and there is a huge demand for it. And I would be interested in seeing what people pay to take the great courses online as opposed to a humanities course in a university, you know. We cover them because we have to. Who would if they didn't have to? It's interesting when you go to the Modern Language Association.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because that's something you do every year, and there's always interesting topics that come up there, aren't there?
Yeah, and the thing about it is, this is not only all the English professors in the country, it's all those that have studies behind it. Name it. Gender, ethnic, fill in the blank. And it is every new wave thing you can think of, some of which can get quite alarming. Yeah, and Spencer Irvine covers this with me, and he walked out of one because they were showing a gay porn flick.
And this is at the Modern Language Association. So
right.
This is supposed to be English professors.
But it's interesting because at the MLA, you'll find lots of sessions that only have two or three attendees. They don't even go to them.
Wow.
But they expect students to, and they get them because they make them requirements. You know, it goes with the whole diversity curriculum. So how long would this survive on just a purely market test of them supplying what there is a demand for? I don't know. I doubt if George Soros could float the entire university system. But at any rate, not only that, but enrollments have dropped 800,000 in the past year or two. However, it's interesting that online distance learning enrollments have gone up by about that same amount, you know? So again, online education is also meeting that market test, or coming as close to meeting that market test as anything you'll find in academia today. Taking it a step further, there's a lot of complaints in academia about the use of adjuncts. And a lot of them, I see them at the MLA, are English professors wannabe, you know, who are teaching four or five courses in the hopes of getting some tenure-track job somewhere. But there's an interesting facet of this that nobody's looking at. That is, there are a lot of adjuncts who have day jobs in the field, you know? And so when you take their course on an evening or a weekend, you are being taught by somebody who actually has field experience in business, in foreign policy in a lot of cases. My wife, for example, went to Southeastern University, which has a troubled administration. However, many of their courses are taught evenings and weekends by Fortune 500 company consultants. So you're actually getting a business course taught by somebody in business. Very valuable.
All right, so basically what you're saying is we have conservative professors that can't come out and tell people that they're conservative for fear of losing their job. We have ineffective programs that students don't even really want to take, but they're being forced to take. And in some cases, the professors don't even really want to listen to it themselves. We've got MLA conferences with all kinds of raunchiness going on, and I don't even know what that has to do with what they're supposed to be teaching. So what do you think people that disagree with the state of the academia, the current state that we have, what can regular people do about it? And what can these conservative professors do? I mean, it sounds like they're risking their job if they come out. I mean, is there anything that they can do to stand up for themselves, or anything other people can do to stand up for them?
With the professors, I tell you one thing. A lot of people don't realize boards of trustees have veto power and approval power over tenure decisions. I know of at least one conservative free market economist at the University of Amherst, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, not a right-wing bastion. In fact, this was proven because he was denied tenure. He then took his case to the Board of Trustees, and they overturned the department decision. So boards of trustees, interestingly enough, are a little like economics departments in that they're more likely to reflect the population as a whole and more likely to be politically and intellectually diverse. unfortunately, they're not as active as they could be. One reason for that, of course, is the use of federal, state, local funds for education, for taxpayer dollars. If the Board of Trustees had more of the power of the purse, they might take more of an interest, you know. But in the meantime, they are there as a resource. The other thing is, if you are a conservative parent and your kids are looking at universities, why pick one that is part of the problem? This gets a little tough because, for instance, my predecessor, Dan Flynn, went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst precisely so that he could stir things up. And there's a certain logic to that, you know. But I don't know that it's worth the effort. That's an individual decision. But I don't know that it's a good idea to enable them, you know. It might not be helpful to them. It might provide a teachable moment for them. You can tell I go to a lot of academic conferences because I know all the academic buzzwords.
All right, Mal. Well, thank you for joining me today. It was good to have you on. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the Media Madness podcast, where we stop the madness every week by analyzing the news and critiquing the media, and this week, critiquing academia. Please visit us at aim.org, and please visit academia.org as well to read our articles and to follow us on, you can also follow us on social media. Please come back next time and join us for our next Media Madness podcast.